Morning, everyone. So last time we were looking at computer networking. And of course, these topics, if they kind of caught your interest, we have entire courses about them. So we're looking at sort of some of the most essential key pieces so that you're familiar with it. And sort of in that spirit, we're moving from networking to essentially secure networking today. Before we do that, any questions or anything? All right. So we've been talking about how to communicate across a network, like the internet. Now we want to extend that and say, how can we do that securely? Now, a lot of these principles don't have to only apply to a network, but that's sort of where I think there's a lot of value because, like we talked about before, there's a lot of pieces of the infrastructure that we don't own, and we don't know exactly what they're doing. We don't know who's operating them or what their goals are. And so we're mostly interested in security across the internet, but of course we could apply this to any other really communication system. And so to talk about this, we kind of need a framework. And sort of the canonical framework looks something like this. We're going to assume that we have two parties, A and B, and they're trying to communicate. Maybe there's a third member of this, C, sometimes, depending on what the scenario is. But generally speaking, right, A and B are trying to communicate securely. And then we have some potential attackers. So E is an attacker who can eavesdrop. Basically can listen for any packets that are being sent or try to observe what's going on. But it's really just that. It's just sort of an observational eavesdropper. M, however, is similar, right? Some machine that exists in the network between, say, A and B, but is potentially taking a more active role. So is actively maybe sort of taking messages out of the network, so like simulating a drop potentially, inspecting those messages, and then potentially generating new messages that are being sent to the network. So it can read, but also replace or add messages. And these are sort of the fundamental kind of concepts that we use to talk about what types of properties are we guaranteeing, what tools do we use to allow A and B to communicate, even though these types of attackers could exist. Any questions on this premise? And so I kind of mentioned this, that one of the challenges with networks is that, especially the internet, they're large. There's a lot of places that a potential attacker could be. So one that we often maybe hear about a fair bit is like using Wi-Fi at a coffee shop. So wireless communication is by nature a broadcast. Your device is transmitting, and even though it's probably trying to transmit to maybe that access point on the ceiling, the signal is propagating broader than that. And so someone else listening in the same room can intercept those messages. Is that inherently a bad thing? No. But there is a sort of a potential for that to be an attack point. What about the actual access point itself, right? This device. I mean, I didn't set this up. I don't own it. I don't know how to log into it. I don't know what firmware it's running. I don't know what it's doing. I mean, I sort of have a guess, right? Because if I connect to it, I get internet access, so that's good. But is it logging every packet it sees? Maybe. And that's just sort of like one piece of network equipment. You can imagine all those routers along the way. We don't know exactly what they're doing. And those are all sort of points where even though we don't think about that infrastructure, an attacker could be there, or the entity operating that equipment could have motives beyond just facilitating a performant internet. Other things, so we've talked a lot about sending messages and having to reach send things. Well, it's really the device that's doing that and deciding what the message is to send. So if I can send a message that is from my IP address, you can create the same string of bits and send that. Right? At the end of the day, it's just a buffer in memory of some ones and zeros. The fact that those numbers have some semantic meaning is great, but it's not enforced in a sense. The hardware won't reject it. So we can spoof messages. We talked about DNS. Right? DNS is great because it allows us to map human readable strings to IP addresses, but we don't always, how do we know that that's the right IP address? Could be someone else's IP address that an attacker is just telling us is the correct mapping. And then also, last, we have all these routers in the network. Sometimes they can get tricked and actually start sending traffic to the wrong place. And so messages that you shouldn't have been able to see, now suddenly you do. And so as an eavesdropper or a machine in the middle, you have sort of even more visibility than you otherwise would. So these are some of the risks in the way that we've modeled and set up the internet. Now, what is it that we're actually trying to do? So for our discussion, we're going to look at two things: confidentiality and authenticity. So confidentiality, that's basically keeping things secret. I want to be able to send messages, and I want my recipient to be able to read them and make sense of them, but nothing else should. Like, this access point shouldn't be able to tell what I'm sending. Any of the routers along the way shouldn't be able to tell what I'm sending. Only my intended recipient. And then authenticity. Being able to prove to my recipient that I was, in fact, the person who sent that message. That's not someone else trying to impersonate me. Any questions on these two? Now, there are a host of other security properties that we won't be able to get into, but there are other goals that we might have. Okay, so last time we were looking at these networking layers, right, and these are the canonical layers. You may have noticed that security isn't really mentioned here. There's a couple reasons for that. So one version is more historical, that when these layers were being defined, we didn't have the same security needs. We didn't really necessarily know what security properties we needed or have the tools for them. But another reason is that we really can't just think of security as just a layer that we can include, because we really need security in a variety of these layers. Now, that being said, for a lot of our discussion today, we're sort of going to imagine that there's kind of a layer above the transport layer, below the application layer. Sort of transport layer security is a lot of what we're going to talk about today. And so if it kind of helps to sort of see where this might fit in, we're kind of imagining something here where we're really operating end-to-end. So A and B are doing this, the two endpoints, just like they would be with the application layer and the transport layer. But applications can be secure. So we could run something like HTTP and then have kind of a layer below it, so to speak, that can enforce some of these security properties. Okay. So our goal is, again, to enable A and B to communicate securely. How can we make that happen? So specifically, if we imagine, so we have this M, this machine in the middle, how do I know, as A, that when I'm just sending messages to the internet and receiving them back, that the thing on the other end is B and not M? Because remember, we can't see what's going on. All we observe are messages going out and messages coming back in. So the general intuition is, well, what if we both know, A and B, we both have something secret. Something that M doesn't know. Well, that should help, right? Because now I can be talking to the network, but if I know a secret and B knows a secret, M can't fake that, because M doesn't know that secret. Or at least that's kind of the idea. So this is a lot of, basically everything we're going to talk about is predicated on this idea that we have some way of having some secret information that parties communicating securely know, and the machine in the middle does not. So our first version of this is we're just going to assume that A and B, we have some secret, some shared secret information that we both know. What's an example of like a shared secret or some secret information that you and somebody else might know? Yeah.
Encrypted password.
Well, how about just a password, right? In theory, your password is secret because you don't just tell that to everyone, right? But when you go to log in, you have to tell your password. And because no one else should know that, but the thing that you're trying to log into would know it, that kind of sort of, you know, verifies things. So we could try something like that. So A and B want to communicate. They both know the secret password. So B sends the password to A. A can check that, right? Verify that that is in fact the correct password. And now, okay, great. So now I know I'm talking to B. So even though machine in the middle, M, didn't know this password at the beginning, this doesn't really work for a couple of reasons. So one, the eavesdropper attacker who's just looking sees the password, so now knows it. But more importantly, sees the actual message, right? Whatever this confidential information was. Now, once M has seen this password, in the future, if A asks the same question, M can just respond. And M knows the password, and so A doesn't really know the difference. So while this idea of a shared secret is very powerful, we can't just use that concept. We need something above that. And that's where encryption comes into play. So encryption is the tool which can take this idea of a shared secret, but then put it to use so that this kind of thing doesn't happen. So that this message isn't just sent in a way that E can read it, and we're not just sending the password that M could use in the future. The simple version of encryption is called symmetric encryption. And the name symmetric, as kind of it implies, means that, again, A and B both have the same shared secret. Now with this, we have we're going to have two operations that we can do. That's this E and D, encrypt and decrypt. And so what the syntax here is basically, it's basically looking like a function call, right? We have E for encrypt. Now, that we need two things to do that. So first is the key. And the key, that's the shared secret. So we have some secret key that both sides know. With that key, we can then perform an algorithm with that and whatever we're trying to send. And when we encrypt that, we end up with what's called a ciphertext. Now, if E, the encryption algorithm, is a good algorithm, that ciphertext to somebody without the key is meaningless. They cannot tell what the message was. But of course, we want the recipient to know, right? So that's where we have the reverse here, or decrypt. Again, we need the same key, but now we insert the ciphertext, and then if we, with that algorithm, we can then get back the original message. And so the key, the principle here is that now we have a way where once we have the shared key on either end, we can encrypt the message, we can send that. Any of the eavesdropper can't learn anything about the message, but our recipient can. Again, it is important that the algorithm we're using is a good one, meaning that even if you know the algorithm and you can see the ciphertext, if you don't have the key, you can't learn the message. So you don't learn anything about it. You don't know the contents or how it relates to other messages or anything. And again, a good algorithm is basically you'd have to try every possible thing to try to figure that out. And that becomes computationally impossible, essentially. Okay, so that's the basics of symmetric encryption. To make it sort of to walk through sort of an example of how this would be used in practice, we're assuming that A and B, so those are our two parties here, they have that encryption key. If A wants to send something confidentially to B, A will use the known algorithm and the key, encrypt whatever the message is, and then get the ciphertext. Now, that ciphertext can be sent on the network, so that's what A does, and A sends that to B. Now, again, all of the infrastructure, just because it's encrypted, doesn't change those earlier properties, right? The routers, the access points, an eavesdropper in a coffee shop, they can still see that message potentially. But now that it's encrypted, it should be meaningless to them. However, B can use the decryption algorithm, that known key, the ciphertext, and then recover the original message. Questions? We're good with this? Oh, yeah.
How are we assuming that B is the P?
Okay, so very good question. This up here, that seems like a fairly strong assumption, right? How did A and B get the same key? And importantly, right, because if you look at this, what did B need? B just needed to know the algorithm, which we assume is known, and all you need is the key. And so if M gets a copy of the key, M can do the same decryption. So we'll talk about that. We'll get there. How can we get this set up? For now, we're just assuming that we have some way to do this. Any other questions? Okay, and so when we say encryption, particularly symmetric encryption, that you were generally talking about this idea of confidentiality. This is typically when like a software library calls something encryption, they're talking about this. However, we can extend this notion to something called an authenticated encryption. Because so far we've the message is secret, but we don't actually know the source. And so if we want to have a notion of authenticity, we can use what's called a message authentication code, or a MAC. So the idea here is a little bit different. So instead of trying to make the actual data secret, we're trying to be able to verify the origin of a particular message. And so instead of having an encrypt or decrypt function, we now have a MAC function. And this is a similar sort of construction here, right? So we compute the MAC. We still need a key. We're going to do that over the message. But instead of getting a ciphertext or the encrypted version of that message, instead we're getting something called a tag. Now the tag doesn't tell us the actual data, but instead it tells us that whoever created that tag for that message must have had the key. And so even if you know the algorithm and you have the message and you have the tag, we don't want to be able to find the key or be able to compute a MAC of something else. And so what this enables is that if we have a valid MAC, we know that came from somebody with the key. Okay, questions? Now this kind of looks similar to something we've seen, which is a checksum, right? Because we're taking the original message, we're computing something new. Doesn't tell us the same data, but if anything were to change, now suddenly that check wouldn't be valid. The difference is that a checksum is usually a very simple check that anyone can compute, and of course there's no key. A MAC is something that's cryptographic and uses that key. Checksums are also meant to be more performant, and really they're about sort of accidents, things that were not intentional but could happen in the course of a message being transmitted through a network, versus a MAC, which is trying to protect against something perhaps actively malicious. Okay, so just sort of a comparison there. If we look at what we can do with a MAC, as an example here, so again, we have sort of this setup step here, which is we're assuming that both sides know the MAC key. Now, what this allows us to do, if A wants to send something to B, specifically, right, whatever the message is, please pay $100 to M, B wants to know, okay, did A actually send this or is B sending this to me? Well, to prove to B that A, in fact, is the sender here, A computes the MAC of this message, so uses that shared key of the message and gets the tag. Now, when A sends that to B, A has to send the message, because remember, the MAC doesn't encapsulate the data in the same way that encryption does. So what A has to send to B is that message, but then also includes the tag. Now we know that M could send to B, please pay $100 to M. But if M tried to do that, M wouldn't be able to generate this valid tag because M doesn't know the shared MAC key. And so when B receives this message, B is going to do the same computation, right? B has the message, B has the shared MAC key, it will compute its own MAC and then check. Is it the same as this? If so, okay, then that must have been generated by A, and if not, then it might have been forged, and it's going to ignore that message. Yeah. So far we're assuming that the MAC key is shared among two, so A and B. If that key was shared among more parties, then we still know that the MAC was created by somebody who has the key, but sort of our guarantees are definitely being weakened. And so generally speaking, well, I think this is just sort of always true. With these symmetric algorithms, we're really assuming there's two endpoints, A and B here. This is kind of nice, but it is a little bit dissatisfying that this message is just transmitted in the clear. Right? Even because we might want to know that A sent it, and we might want to keep that secret. Maybe we don't want to know what everyone to be able to know how much B should pay to M. Well, we can combine these two techniques. So we can use MAC with this notion of encryption. And the idea is basically we just do an extra step, right? So instead of sending the message in the clear, we encrypt that first. And then we input that in as the message we compute the MAC over. We still get the tag, and we still send both, but now we send the encrypted version. So we send the encrypted version and the tag. When the recipient gets it, the recipient B recomputes the MAC on the encrypted data, verifies that what it computes matches the tag that was actually transmitted, so we know it actually was generated by A, and then can use the encryption key, the shared encryption key, to decrypt that ciphertext and get back the actual intended message. Yeah?
You're using symmetric encryption and you're assuming that the key is secret on both sides, then doesn't encrypting with that key already kind of guarantee that it was the original sender?
Okay, so do we need the MAC, basically? Like, does the encryption step itself, because we're using the original key? So not quite. So it's possible to generate a valid encrypted message that is in fact encrypted using the key, even if you don't know the key. So it does not guarantee that authenticity. That's why we have to add the MAC.
When you send your message from A to B, you are tagging on the MAC address to the end of the encrypted message. Is that the idea? Is that what that is showing there? And then the MAC address there? Or?
Yes. So here, basically, we're assuming we're sending the bytes of the ciphertext and then the bytes of the MAC tag. Now, yeah, so it is worth noting that we do have a thing called a MAC address in the networking layer. This is a different MAC. And so that's why we'll refer to this as a tag. Yeah, it's a different MAC. Yeah.
I guess a follow-up question to that then would be, how does the computer know where the encrypted message ends and the tag begins then?
Yeah, good question. So A sends to B this sort of ciphertext, and then the tag, and how does B know like which is which? Maybe it sent the tag first, and then the encrypted data, and so that sort of has to be agreed upon in advance. So there's going to be some protocol that's going to specify how are we doing this. So like, which encryption algorithm are we using? And so again, like we shared the keys, we probably just shared that information and just said, okay, A and B both agreed that they're going to do it in this particular way. And so those details have to be defined either in a protocol or just between the two parties that they agree to do the same thing. All right. Any other questions? So that's basically, we combine these two techniques, that's how we get the authenticated encryption idea. So we know the source and we have the data as secret. All right, so if we apply these techniques, what do we get? So in this scenario, right, we're assuming A and B have shared keys, that we know they both know the same MAC algorithm, the same encryption, decryption algorithm. And A sends a message with that's basically composed of these three parts. So let's take a couple minutes, work with your neighbors. What can an eavesdropper learn, if anything? And what could a machine in the middle change, if anything? All right, okay, so question part one here. Can an eavesdropper learn who is being paid? No, right, because we only know the recipient in the encrypted message. Can the eavesdropper learn how much? Yes, right? Because that's just sent in the clear right there. All right, two, can a machine in the middle change who is being paid? So the machine in the middle could potentially, because that information is only in the encrypted, and so the machine couldn't learn who was the original recipient, but could potentially generate a new ciphertext that had a different recipient, and B wouldn't be able to check because it's not elsewhere. And then can B change how much? Or sorry, can the M change how much? So M could certainly replace this, right? And say, make this, just add an extra zero, make it 1,000. But because we include that in the MAC, then because that was a MAC over the pay 100, the B will be able to check that, wait a minute, that doesn't match. And the machine in the middle won't be able to forge the fake MAC, so will not be able to change how much. Okay. All right, yeah. Well, we didn't get into that detail just for time, but it's possible that the machine in the middle can generate a new ciphertext with a different recipient here, but still can't decrypt this message. That's why we need the additional MAC. Yeah.
If we put like the name in the MAC, then would it have been no?
That's right. So if we had included that in here, right, then sure, maybe the machine will could have changed or create a new ciphertext, but again, if we had added this here and probably this here, then again, we would be able to check that with the MAC. And B would know that that was not the original encrypted message. Okay, so far we've been, we've been talking about this symmetric encryption thing, and there's been this lingering question of like, wait a minute, how did A and B get these shared secrets? And so this kind of brings up this question, right? So I need to somehow securely communicate so that I can then set up a secure communication, which is sort of like, well, wait a minute, how do we do that? That's one issue. The second issue is that because these are sort of between two parties, we would need to set up these keys between sort of you and every website you might want to visit. And like most things, maybe you could do that for one thing, like, say, SIS, right? Maybe you could go to an office and talk to a person, and you could both write down a shared secret key. You take your copy, they take theirs, and set it up. Maybe you could do that for, like, one website, but to do that for the entire internet is completely infeasible. And so we need something else. Now, to do this, we're okay with not having exactly the same properties we saw with symmetric encryption. So specifically, we're okay with a scheme where we can do confidentiality in one direction, and we're okay if it's a little bit less performant. And the reason we're okay with those two things is because with those sort of relaxations, we can use a technique. Again, if we had symmetric encryption, this is asymmetric encryption. And this is where things get really powerful to support secure communication on the internet. There's a lot of similarities here with any sort of encryption scheme. The difference is that instead of having one key, we now have two keys. And so for encryption, we're going to use a public key encryption algorithm. The key that we use, instead of being a single shared key, we now have two different keys. The key we use for encryption is called the public key. We still want to encrypt the message. We still generate a ciphertext. But importantly, what's different from the symmetric case is that public key cannot decrypt that message. So even if you know the public key and you know the ciphertext, you cannot recreate the message. However, there's a different key, the private key, which can. So with the decryption algorithm and the private key, we can take the ciphertext and recover the message. Now, because we have the two keys, we now have a key pair of the public key and the private key. As the name sort of implied, public key can be shared because it's only used for encryption. So anybody who has it can encrypt something, but they can't use it to then recover or decrypt an encrypted message. The private key, however, again, as its name implies, must always be kept secret. So don't share your private key, ever. I was just talking to somebody yesterday who said that their coworker posted a private key to their company Jira. Like, don't do that, right? It's called private for a reason. And so this gives us these properties. We can do the encryption and decryption, and if we know the public key, we can't decrypt an encrypted message. But if we know the private key, we can. And even if we know the algorithms, the public key, and a message, and its corresponding ciphertext, that does not let us learn the private key, which could be used to decrypt other messages. Okay, so our sort of hardness guarantee is not quite as strong as the symmetric case, but it's still impractical to compute, at least with today's computers, as far as we know, impractical to sort of brute force this. So if you don't know the private key, it's very, very difficult to again do the decryption. Now that doesn't mean that sort of all the problems are solved, but it does give us a good primitive to build things on. And so there's definitely some similarities, right? But there's that key difference of what keys exist and what can the keys do. So asymmetric, we need a key pair, and that gets us sort of encryption one direction. So if we want to have bidirectional, using only asymmetric encryption, we need two key pairs, so both parties can encrypt to the other. Public keys can be shared, private keys must be kept private. Symmetric, a little bit different, right? We have the shared key, and then that enables communication in both directions, but we need some way to set up those keys. So in practice, right, using this looks similar to what we've seen. So now our in advance is a little bit easier now because B can generate this key pair on its own. Now it's going to keep its private key, local, secret, hidden away. The public key, however, B can just send to A. And if an eavesdropper can see it, that's fine. Now, if A wants to send something securely to B, A can use that public key with whatever the message is, encrypt it, that ciphertext can be sent on the network. Because no one else other than B has that private key, they can't decrypt that. So we can send that, and then B does have the private key, and so can decrypt to get the original message. So again, similar sort of flow, just which keys we use is a little bit different. Any questions on asymmetric encryption, the general structure? All right. So just like last time, we talked about encryption. Can we also do something like those MAC codes? And so we do have a mirror, believe it or not. So symmetric encryption had max, asymmetric encryption has something called a digital signature. And the use of the term signature is very intentional, because it's also the verb we're going to use. So what we want to be able to do is, given a message, use our private key to sign that message, akin to writing a signature on a document, sort of attesting that, yes, this is something that we've seen or that we created. But we're doing it cryptographically, and we can prove it because of the algorithm, the fact that we have that private key. But of course, the signature itself is kind of meaningless unless somebody else can look at it and go, well, is that actually your signature? And so to do that, we also have another step called verify. And we can't use the private key because only the signer has the private key. Remember, you're not sharing your private key. But we can do the verification with a matching public key. We take the original message, we take the signature, and then we can check, was that signature generated from that message using the corresponding private key? If so, then the signature checks out. And we want similar properties to our asymmetric encryption case, where even if you see these messages and you can't learn what the private key is, and you can't then sign future messages, again, unless you have that private key. And so like we saw,
I'm confused how you can use a public key to verify anything.
Yeah, so wait, how can we use the public key to verify? Because the private key is what we use to make the signature. And the short answer is that's how the math works. So there's basically a construct where if we generate keys in a specific way, then we can do this. The private key and public key correspond in such a way that this operation is possible. I think at this point you'll sort of have to just take our word for it. But it is in fact possible. And so to use that, it would look something like this. We set up just like before, but now we're interested in computing the signature. So we're going to sign our message with our private key to create the signature. We can send that on the network, but we also have to send the message. Because without the message, then it's like having the signature form, but not the rest of the document, right? So we have to have whatever was actually signed, and then that's what we can use to verify with the corresponding public key, whatever the message was, and the signature. And if that checks out, then it's verified, and we know that whoever owns that private key was in fact the entity that generated that signature. Any questions? Any other questions on signatures? Anything look odd about this? Yeah. Okay. So one good question is, how does this happen? Right. So the public key doesn't need to be secret, but B needs to know that the public key it gets is actually A's public key and not, say, M's public key. So that's one issue, which we'll talk about. Is there something else that feels off here? Yeah.
I don't know, I guess if E read the message and had the public key, then they could compute B and all their stuff.
Sorry, who can compute B? M or?
I think anyone.
Anyone can, yeah. Right. Yes, so anybody can verify the signature, assuming that they know the public key and have the message and have the signature. But interestingly, once we have the signature, if we check it again, it will still be true, right? And so we can take make a photocopy, right? So just like we had a form with your signature on it, someone can just duplicate that, and it'll still be your signature. And so that can be used in something called a replay attack. So now, again, A and B are communicating. Let's say they have some exchange like this. So at the top here we have A says, did you order lunch? And B says, yes. Now A and B want to be able to verify that these messages are coming from who they think they're coming from, and so they ensure that they sign their messages before sending it. And they already have these keys set up so they can do this. They can sign with their private key, and the other party can check using the public keys that, in fact, it was signed by this message, or signed by the intended sender. So they have a conversation, right? Did you order lunch? Yes. Vegetarian? No, not this time. Then later, right, A asks me a question. There's a guy at the door, says here to repair the AC. Should I let him in? Signed by A, because A is asking this question. And now what is A looking for? A is looking for an answer from B, signed by B, on what A should do. See a problem here? There's already a message that fits that, right? The message is yes. It is, in fact, signed by B, and that signature will check out. And so an attacker can look at that earlier message, make a copy of it, and when A asks this question, send back a perfectly valid signed message from B saying yes. Now, maybe the attacker is the HVAC person, or the person claiming to be, right? So this is a replay attack. They've taken an existing message and just resent it. And so we have to be, so even though we have these cryptographic properties, if we're using the same message and the same keys, we're gonna get the same result. And so to defend against this, a key technique is called a nonce. A nonce meaning a number used once. And the idea here is that by changing the numbers that we're using these messages and not reusing them, now we don't have this case where we're signing the exact same message again. Right? So this still happens, but now instead of the message just being yes, the message is now the number one plus yes. And so an attacker can still make a copy of that. It's still validly signed by B. But if the attacker tries to insert that here, assuming A actually does the check, A is going to check the signature, see that it is in fact valid, but the nonce is old, right? Because we're up to 54, and the message has an old nonce. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute, wait a minute. That's already been used. I'm not going, like, this, something is wrong. And we'll ignore that. Yeah?
How do you think the attacker knows the value of the message was yes?
In this example, are the messages not encrypted? Yes. Okay. Right. We're just assuming we have the signatures. All right. So this is good. It's not quite enough in practice, however, because what if our attacker is trying to, or wants a message that can go here, that does have this correct nonce, and does have yes, and is signed by B. Well, it can't use this message because that has the wrong nonce. What if the attacker has its own conversation with B? So forgive that the numbers don't quite line up, but you get the idea. So now our attacker's talking to B, has the same agreement that we're going to have the signatures there, and now M has a signed message with a different nonce signed by B that it could potentially use later. And so if then later A asks B something and M is intercepting this, M is like, okay, I need a message that I can send that A will check out correctly. Oh, but wait, I had this earlier conversation. Let me just use that message, which was signed, and insert it here. And from A's point of view, it's the right nonce, the right message, and it's signed by B. And so getting all of these pieces right is actually fairly difficult to defend against a variety of different attacks. Any questions? All right, so in general, to avoid the ability to reuse signed messages, we'll use nonces. But there was another question, right, that came up earlier, which is, wait a minute, how does A, because all of this has been predicated on A knowing that B's public key is actually this, what it thinks it is. And how do we know that when we asked B for its public key, M didn't just send their public key? Because, a public key is going to look like a public key. We're not going to be able to just sort of tell. And if there was some way to just tell, well, M would just fake that too. So one idea is we verify. So this is kind of like the case of, like, we go to the office. You would say, okay, I want to log into SIS. SIS, tell me your public key. And some person there would read out a bunch of numbers to you, and you would write it down, and you'd go home. And then when your computer asked for SIS's public key, SIS would send you something, and you would check. And this is kind of how SSH works. That's okay, but again, it's not really scalable. You wouldn't want to do that for every website. Have to, like, call them up and be like, hey, can you verify your public key in some way that would be hard to forge or hard for the same attacker to intercept? So we need some way to delegate trust is the idea here. We need some way to know that the public key we get is actually the public key we think it is. And so we have this idea of a certificate. So a certificate is essentially a public key, but it's been certified by something else. So let's say A and B have already, A has already obtained B's public key, and now C wants to know B's public key, and happens to already know A's. So A has B's, C has A's, and then what we want is this. Can we have B give C the public key? And the notion of a certificate says, okay, well, we already have, we already know A is set, A already knows what's going on. And so if we trust A, we can say, hey, A, can you generate a certificate containing B's public key and sign it with your own private key. So A is going to use its own private key to sign B's public key. B sends the certificate to C. Now what can C do? Well, C already knows A's public key, so C can verify that A did in fact sign this. And if we trust that A didn't do something incorrect, like A didn't sign the wrong key and just call it B's because we trust A, well, now C knows that this thing it got that claims to be B's public key is in fact B's public key because we delegated that trust to A. So we generate the certificate. B can hold a copy of that certificate, and when C asks, B can send that certificate, and now C can use that trust to be confident that the public key it thinks is B is actually B's. Does that idea make sense? Right, we kind of do this all the time. You ask somebody for some information, and whether you trust them or not is whether or not you're going to believe what they say. If you ask for somebody's address, somebody's phone number, like, is your friend lying to you? You would evaluate that trust. And so we use that same type of idea on the internet. Now, we don't sort of delegate trust to just anyone, because that wouldn't work. Because why would we do that? And so instead, we delegate trust very strategically to what's called a certificate authority. Now, as the name kind of implies, this is some entity which is going to generate certificates, and it's going to be the authority on that. We trust it. It's going to do this for a lot of different websites. So if I want to create a new website, I have a private key. I want to share my public key, and I want others to trust that it's actually my public key, not someone else's. So I'm going to go to a certificate authority, and I'm going to say, hey, could you please create a certificate? Could you sign my public key with your private key, creating the certificate, so that I can then take the certificate to others and say, yes, this is my public key, and they will believe me. Why? Because they trust you. And so this is happening all the time. Every time we go to a website, more or less these days, especially if it has the S in the HTTPS, your browser is doing this. Your browser is looking at the public key sent by the website, checking that it was signed by a known trusted certificate authority. And if so, it's then assuming, it's then trusting that you're actually talking to the correct website and not someone trying to impersonate that website. And you can actually go and you can look at these. So if you go into your browser and usually by the address, there's like a lock or a little configuration thing. You click it, it'll say, this connection is secure. And you go, tell me more. All right, and you can click on that, and then you can go view certificate. And you can actually see the certificate that your browser got from that website, which shows why it decided to trust that. Trust that that website is, in fact, what it claims to be. And so here you can see that for this domain, it was signed by this certificate authority. And then also included in the certificate, a little bit further down, is the public key. Okay, so we have a public key that's defined here, and it was signed by the certificate authority. And now we trust that this is in fact Canvas that we're talking to, and not some impersonator. All right, so Canvas was signed by this. Anybody heard of in-common RSA server before? Can't say it's come up that often for me either. So, okay, cool. Canvas, you've got a certificate signed by incoming RSA server, CA. That's great, but we've been in class for, what, a little over an hour, and we've already talked about how we can generate this and create public keys, and I could sign your public key too. So why do we trust that certificate? Would you trust incoming RSA? I guess you do, because your browser will let you go to Canvas and doesn't throw up an error. So why do we trust that? Well, because that certificate, that thing's public key was signed by somebody else. Specifically, user trust RSSA certification authority. You good with that? Common company, right? Big name, you know, use it all the time. Why do we trust that? Anyone know? Why does your browser trust user trust RSA certification authority? Yeah.
Because eventually it gets signed off by like ICANN.
Okay. All right. So we could sign this certificate or this, you know, this public key with another. We can sign it by somebody else, ICANN or Google or anybody. Okay. I could sign this and I could call myself Google. Right? I can spell that. Would you trust it? Because again, I mean, don't we have the same problem? Okay, we're assuming that user trust RSSA, let's say that's even a valid company. We can check that, in fact, they signed it. How do we check that? We use their public key to verify that they, in fact, signed it. How do we know that the public key we have is, in fact, their public key and not my public key, and I'm impersonating them? Where does this recursive problem stop? Anyone know? We just do it enough times and like, yeah, who would go through the trouble? All right, so it has to stop somewhere. So we need some source of like truth. And the way we do that is the software we run just has hard-coded values. So your browser, your operating system, just has a list that it ships with of public keys that it just trusts. And if there's a chain, this hierarchy, if we can sign back to something, whatever it is that we're trying to do, you know, collab back, you know, before, right, whatever, if there's a chain back to something that we trust implicitly because it came with our software, then we will trust that this site is, in fact, who they say they are. And browsers ship with a number of these things. This is actually a pretty complicated issue, right? How many browsers are there? Like 4? Firefox, Chrome, Safari and Edge, more or less, you know, most of the market share. And then how many operating systems are there? Like 3, roughly? You know, one big one, right, Windows. So those companies decide who gets to be in this list. And if you're not in this list, well then your computer won't trust them. Who gets to decide who's in that list? Does the state certificate authority from Russia get to be in that list? Do we trust that? Should all of our computers trust that? Does Google allow, I don't know, Microsoft to be in their trust? So this is where we kind of leave the technology realm, and this becomes much more of a policy question. And so this is something that has definitely changed over time, as we have to figure out, like, how do we as a globe, as an internet community, agree on what these should be. Okay. So, all right, we're going to skip ahead a little bit here. But we have some pieces. We'll skip over the hash. And we'll skip over this. Okay. And kind of get to the punchline here, which is that we've seen a lot of the pieces that we need for our transport layer security goal. And so TLS is what's widely used on the internet to make that S in HTTPS so that two devices on the internet can communicate securely, even though the underlying infrastructure may not be secure. And this is a protocol where we exchange messages, and it basically, at a high level, we start by setting up those keys. So we're going to exchange public, or we're going to get the public key from the server. We're going to verify that that public key is in fact the server's public key using that certificate authority idea we just walked through. And once we've done that, we're going to use that to then set up symmetric keys between the two devices. Because remember, symmetric keys are just easier to compute, so it's more performant. But we did that securely, so nobody else. So we can exchange over the network, but nobody else can learn those shared keys. And then we can do all the communication we want, encrypting with those shared keys. And then when we're sort of finished, then that's when we wrap up the communication. Okay, so we've sort of seen kind of, again, some of the key elements: asymmetric encryption, symmetric encryption, certificate authorities, to what's really powers the secure communication. All right. So that's where we're going to leave it for our discussion in this class. These are the key properties. Now, again, there's obviously a lot of detail that we didn't get a chance to get into. We have a network security class, but this gives us enough intuition that we can use it for kind of understanding how we can build a secure channel, even though we have this untrusted infrastructure. All right. Thanks, everyone.